Hello and welcome to the Autosport Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Kalanorkas. Lewis Hamilton is now the sole holder of Formula One's all-time win record as he triumphed from pole position in the Portuguese Grand Prix at Portimão ahead of Valtteri Bottas. But the race wasn't quite as straightforward as that sounds for Mercedes. At the start, on what was a cold and blustery day compared to the warm and sunny days that had preceded the race, Hamilton and Bottas both struggled to get temperature into the medium tyres that they had been so pleased to qualify on in Q2. Bottas actually lost out to Max Verstappen off the line, but managed to muscle his way back into second at turn three, with Verstappen then tangling with Sergio Perez in a clash that spun the Racing Point driver down to the back of the pack. But just up ahead, Hamilton was being caught out by light rain as he locked up running into the turn five hairpin. He went deep there but managed to stay ahead, although not for long, as Bottas powered by at turn seven where the track was at its wettest after Hamilton had to catch a snap of oversteer coming through the kink of turn six, which cost him momentum. But suddenly, both Mercedes drivers were caught and passed by the fast-starting Carlos Sainz Jr., who was enjoying great grip on his soft tyres having started 7th, with Sainz passing Bottas out of the Turn 5 hairpin on the second tour. Sainz blasted into the lead as his teammate Lando Norris had passed Verstappen to run 4th, and behind, the Red Bull even came under brief pressure from Kimi Raikkonen, who had gained a remarkable 10 places on a charging opening lap and a half from F1's most experienced driver. Sainz pulled clear of the Mercedes initially, but when they finally fired up their mediums, keeping the tyres into the right temperature window was critical across the race, they easily got back into the lead and simply disappeared. Bottas held on until the start of lap 20, but as he began to struggle with the vibration caused by tyre wear Hamilton was not encountering, he was just under pressure. Hamilton used DRS to blast by into turn one, with Bottas defending close to the inside against the pit wall, and Hamilton was never headed thereafter, save for the lap he came into the pits to switch to the hards, before Bottas also came in to take the same rubber one lap later. After Bottas struggled again to get the hards switched on, Hamilton established a crushing 25.5 second margin of victory, with Verstappen, who escaped even an investigation into the clash with Perez, finishing third after easily seeing off any faint hope Charles Leclerc had of taking a podium for Ferrari following his long first stint on the mediums. The McLarens had faded as their opening stint wore on, but Sainz was in the thick of the action at the end as he passed the recovering Perez, who had defended forcibly against the charging Pierre Gasly a little bit earlier. That move initially stopped the AlphaTauri's progress, but was deemed bad enough to earn Perez a reprimand, his second of the weekend after the race. In the end, Gasly got by to take 5th, Sainz then 6th, and Perez was 7th, with the Renault drivers 8th and 9th, and Sebastian Vettel rounding out the top 10. Norris was down in 13th after having to recover from a clash with Lance Stroll at turn 1 on lap 18, for which the Racing Point driver was handed a 5-second time penalty, getting another for repeated track limits offences before he retired due to damage sustained in the clash with the McLaren. Now, joining Luke Smith and me, we're back from the track at our Airbnb apartment, which is just along the coast from the town of Portimão itself, to discuss all of that and more via Zoom on motorsport.com's F1 editor Jonathan Noble and GP Racing executive editor Stuart Codling. Now, Codders, we have finally got through my monologue, which might have taken one or two attempts to get all the way to the end, but there we go. How excited were you at the end of lap two when it was Sainz in the lead for McLaren and not a Mercedes?
Well, it was extraordinary scenes. I was almost as excited as the commentator, who appeared to be having a coronary in front of me. I wanted to send sort of medicinal drugs to sort the poor fellow out. You almost didn't know where to look. I almost thanked my lucky stars that I was watching it at home. I was able to rewind and keep a tab on everything that happened over those first two laps, because it seemed like all the excitement of the Grand Prix was contained within the first two laps, but then actually it stretched out. There were a few lulls, but as you've just said in your extensive monologue, and quite frankly, it's so all-encompassing, we don't need to do a podcast, really. But the excitement went all the way to the end. This was a Grand Prix which had what Formula One is trying to engineer into future years, which is to have what they call the peak end effect, where there's a lot of excitement concentrated towards the end. So while sort of in the second half of the race, the battle for the lead perhaps was not up for dispute because Valtteri Bottas had been well and truly stamped out by Lewis Hamilton, there was an awful lot of stuff going on behind them. So yeah, it was very exciting. And I imagine, Alex, it's been an interesting and quite tricky time for you working out what your, always a high bone of contention, the driver ratings are going to look like.
actually relatively simple. I was saying to Luke as I was sort of going, I always like to have a bit of a rough go before we record the podcast. Basically, I know it's going to be a difficult one when there's six or seven drivers. I'm really not sure what score they are, but basically, it's only about two of them that I'm either going one way or the other. Mm-hmm. Everyone else has got a pretty clearly defined position. But actually, Colin, just before we move on, and for the first time potentially, you've told me something very useful: peak end effect. That's something that I have googled many times because I was like, I'm sure there's this thing that we're all obsessed with, and that's what people ultimately want out of life, the something being the best it can be right at the very end. And for the life of me, I must have tried to put this in one of my columns for Autosport Plus several times, couldn't remember, but finally you've come to my rescue, so I do appreciate that.
Oh, phew.
Yes, I know. Thank you. Anyway.
John. I've actually justified my existence here for once.
I mean, you were due the chance to get there.
Yeah. It was going to happen once in a blue moon, and here we have it, the blue moon.
An excellent beer. Other beers are available. John, what was the key to Sainz's amazing start for McLaren, who's seventh on the grid?
I think the key for both him and Kimi, because Kimi had an absolute stunner as well, was getting those tyres switched on straight away. It was interesting because it wasn't as though Carlos and Kimi were the only two drivers on the soft tyres. There were drivers ahead. Albon was up there. Ricciardo was up there on the soft. And they didn't do it, basically. Quite why, whether there was a certain preparation that the McLaren does or that Kimi does that meant they were in the window or not, it didn't really matter, but those two came charging through. I think maybe some of the drivers were just also caught out. I know Daniel Ricciardo said that when he was observing the Mercedes ahead of him, and when they started backing off, he was worried that maybe it was slippery ahead or maybe the grip wasn't there, so he too needed to back off. He said if he replayed the race again, he'd be much more aggressive on the first lap. So I think it's just one of those great moments where it's all down to the driver, it's not down to the car as such, and those that are willing to take the risks, willing to push it, had everything absolutely nailed, excelled, and I think it was really, really refreshing to see a different race leader. Yeah.
You know, if you see a Mercedes, as Daniel said in his presser, you know, if you see a Mercedes slithering all points west ahead of you, you're going to think, well, actually, this patch of asphalt I'm about to arrive on in 2 or 3 seconds' time is not going to be very friendly, so I'm just going to be really, really careful. And as you said, you know, actually, it wasn't that bad. And for those first few laps, the soft tyre was the one to be on, but then after that it was definitely not.
Thank you very much for using asphalt and not tarmac, Godders, as per the Autosport style guide. Luke,
always.
Oh yes, you are very kind on that. Luke, was it inevitable that the Mercedes would get back by? Because as you and I went for our final and deeply unpleasant COVID test of the weekend about 7 o'clock tonight, you know, you were saying that this is what F1 wants to get to, when we can just have random drivers leading the race and potentially staying there because they've got a decisive advantage by doing something seriously impressive as Sainz did. But yeah, what was it? Obviously, it was, given the pace of the W11s, always inevitable that the Mercs were going to come back.
Yes, it was, unfortunately. And I think that, again, as I said to you earlier, that does point to where F1 is right now, that even if you give a driver who can start seventh on the grid and catapult himself up the order, make it a blistering start as Sainz did, and get into a lead and sit a couple of seconds clear, that isn't enough to gain any kind of real advantage. But that is the issue that F1 has, that ultimately you can have a driver make it a blistering start, get up into the lead and sit a couple of seconds clear, and that really be meaningless. I mean, Sainz, by the time we came around for lap six, he was back in second place again. So I think it does prove really that unless you have some really sort of, I guess, a real damaging effect on Mercedes race, such as we saw at Monza, for example, where Valtteri Bottas was struggling with damage and down sort of in fifth or sixth place, and Lewis Hamilton was obviously at the back of the pack and had to serve a penalty, that it really did that is the only way that you can really stop the Mercedes right now, to be honest. And I think it was always inevitable that the Mercs were going to get past by the time that those mediums got up to temperature, but all the same, massive props to Carlos Sainz and McLaren for gunning it and for going it. Like, both him and Lando Norris said that they didn't want to mess around. They wanted to be aggressive. They really focused on tyre warm-up throughout the formation lap, and that was evident, as we saw in the opening stages. And Sainz said it was actually quite easy to pass the Mercedes. Like you said, he didn't really have to put much effort in because his tyres were just that much better. So I think it was, it was a very dramatic start, but ultimately, as exciting as it may have been to see a McLaren at the front of the pack, I think we always knew that it was a bit too good to be true and was always only going to last a few laps.
Indeed. Now, before we come on to talk about the Mercedes drivers and the race for the win up front, Cottis, what were you thinking about Kimi's amazing first lap? I know that I wrote a feature for GP Racing magazine where I interviewed him at Monza, and he's F1's most experienced driver, but he can make, as we saw at the Nürburgring, some quite rookie errors when he clattered into George Russell. Not on display today. He was absolutely sublime at the start and very racy with Sainz through the middle phase of the race, and did very well to come home 11th, which is a pretty massive Class C win, and very unfortunate not to get a point, really.
Class C is the right thing, isn't it, for anyone with a Ferrari engine? No, the thing with Kimi is that I think the Nürburgring incident was a bit of an aberration, because he races really cleanly. And that's been something you've seen throughout his career, and it was amazing to watch that. In the Daniel Ricciardo presser, he said like he didn't even see where he came from, and he couldn't understand how he'd managed to switch on those tyres, because he was just there, and it just made for a very interesting and an aberrant tapestry for those first few laps to see, sort of. And it was quite nice, actually, wasn't it, to see Kimi in the sort of the tail end of his career. We actually think that if we're going to be very strictly honest about it, he was probably past his best and past his peak when he was the world champion. And for him to string out a career 13 years beyond that and to still be up front is pretty impressive.
Indeed, but it's interesting. I was saying to Luke ahead of the weekend, we were talking about, because of course having written that feature and also rewatching, I was rewatching the Mercedes episode of the Netflix documentary just for a bit of research for another feature that might be coming up in a very special edition of or not actually an edition of Autosport magazine, but a special Autosport something to celebrate our 70th anniversary. Anyway, Raikkonen was running third, fourth up on the first lap in the Alfa Romeo, because that's what its pace was capable of with that amazing Ferrari engine last year, and obviously now well down the back. But yeah, Verstappen said he was absolutely shocked to see Kimi that far up, and in fact had to get pretty firm with him when Kimi even went on the offensive against Verstappen at the turn 5 hairpin on lap 2, because Max was just like, I cannot afford to get stuck behind an Alfa, and I needed to get charging after the McLarens ahead and then the Mercedes.
And of course, Max has been pretty offensive himself this weekend, hasn't he, in other spheres? Sorry to interrupt there, carry on.
No, there were certainly some really not on radio messages from Max Verstappen on Friday, Luke. I know you were particularly unimpressed by what he had to say.
Oh, massively, yeah. Like, you just... It's just... Got to be careful with how I say this. It was offensive. It was ableist, and it's also the fact that everyone's kind of just given it a free pass and let it slide. Like Christian Horner said, but he said, well, it's emotion and all of that and whatever. It's not emotion. Like, I'm sorry, you do not say those words. And I think it is. I mean, I know we are in 2020. I know sort of the world has moved on to quite a maybe hypersensitive place at points, but comments like that are unacceptable, and they are offensive. And it was actually quite interesting to have to explain to some journalists why those comments are deemed offensive and why those words should not be used ever. And it's just like, yeah, I'm sorry, for a driver who's 23 years old to be coming out with phrases like that, and in one of them a repeat phrase that he has used previously, and not to have learned his lesson, I think is frankly appalling. And I really do hope that Red Bull have spoken to him, they have fully put home to him why he cannot say those words, because I don't care what's going on in the car. And Alex and I mean, we listened to Lando Norris's radio message when he had his run in with Stroll, and Lando came out with some very other choice words, but they weren't offensive. They were swear words, but they were not slurs. Max Verstappen used slurs, so yeah, I just really hope Red Bull do tell him to grow up, because he needs to.
Yeah, well said, I think, there, Luke. And just instilling on the Lando Norris team radio, he delivers his swearing, which is something that I'm always a particular fan of, a good bit of swearing, with excellent comedic timing, particularly the word he uses right at the very end. But anyway, let's move on, as I said.
Was it to do with John Inverdale's spectacles?
I believe it was, Connors. I believe it was. But as I said, let's talk about the battle at the front of the race for what there was one between the Mercedes drivers early on. Valtteri Bottas obviously getting ahead of Lewis Hamilton when Hamilton really, strangely in a way, didn't seem to be able to cope as he normally does so well in the mixed conditions at the start of the race. It was actually quite strange to see him really struggling. He calls on the radio that it's raining and his things aren't going his way. Bottas obviously got the bad start from the less grippy side of the grid, but seemed to be on top. And you thought, oh, well, he's done so well in practice. Yeah, he's had the knockback, the almost typical knockback in qualifying, but maybe this is now Bottas's chance to get ahead. And he keeps Hamilton ahead for the next... keeps Hamilton behind for the next sort of 15 laps or so. And then inevitably, Lewis starts setting a string of fastest laps. The gap comes down. He's all over Bottas. He's done one of the classic hits of this left tire doesn't feel very good. Oh, suddenly he can do another 25 laps. And then he gets by in a very easy move. Bottas went right off the line, kicking up all the dust, but had no chance to hold Hamilton back with the DRS. And it just looked as if it was the typical Valtteri Bottas problem. The difference between the two Mercedes drivers is that not only has Lewis Hamilton got that fraction of extra speed over a single lap, he's much, much, much better at managing those Pirelli tyres. We've seen it time and time again. I asked Bottas, because he said that there was a big vibration on the mediums before he came in to change them. I said, was that caused by a specific incident? Had you flat spotted them? And he said, no, it was just the tyre wear. And again, that's what's ultimately cost him today. So yeah, John, what did you make of Bottas's performance through that critical phase of the race where he fell behind Hamilton and then fell really far behind because Hamilton simply raced away?
Yeah, I think the difference between Lewis and Valtteri was, that analogy between a sprint and a marathon, basically. So this is a weekend where Valtteri was... he was the best sprinter. I think he was the quickest over a single lap in theory. He had the pace all weekend, could pull it off. In equal conditions when you weren't managing tyre wear, he was gone early on and it looked like, he was going to unleash the pace we'd seen throughout practice and was disappearing. But Lewis was playing a long game. He played the long game in qualifying where he thought, what will be the elements give me the advantage over Valtteri, who's potentially quicker? He did those two times laps with the kind of recharge lap in the middle, which gave him the performance he needed for pole position. And today he had a setup that allowed him to nurse the tyres and look after the tyres and manage things just much, much better. And in the end, that was the difference between them. He did exactly what he did at the Nürburgring, where Valtteri was gone, saw the tyres where Lewis watched what Valtteri's front tyres were doing, saw there was a potential weakness there, pushed Valtteri. Valtteri made a mistake at Nürburgring. Here he just drove past him. So it was just Lewis playing the long game, understanding, he didn't need to worry about out-and-out pace to get pole position in qualifying, but he got that anyway. And in the race, that setup was perfect. And, different league today, really.
He certainly was. There was one another interesting moment in terms of Bottas's tyre strategy was that he came on the radio again once he'd been told that Hamilton had gone on to the hard, suggesting, well, in that case, I'll have the softs. And Mercedes basically very quite firmly said no to him. In fact, as he comes in, as he's on his way into the pit lane, they get James Vowles on the radio saying, I had to stop Lewis because he had a big vibration, which is basically code for you're not getting the softs because if the mediums can't take it, these are definitely not going to work. But Cotters, again, what did you make of that little attempt by Bottas to try and engineer a different strategy, even though, like, on the face of it, yeah, it sort of sounds... yeah, get the softs versus the hards, maybe he'd be able to do something. But he was so far behind by that stage and had so far to go, it didn't even seem to make much sense why he would even be considering it.
No, it was a ridiculous assertion, wasn't it? And I suppose, when you hear team radio, you're only hearing the sort of the selected snatches of it, even when... we have the various bits that we get that aren't necessarily broadcast. It's not the whole picture. And he... naturally said, I want to do the opposite to what Lewis is doing. But actually, if he had put on softs, it wouldn't have been a great thing because Ocon who'd done a magnificent 55 lap stint on the mediums and gone on to softs, was actually not enjoying them at all. So if he had gone on to softs, I don't think Bottas would have been able to engineer the miracle result he hoped for. And it was actually quite interesting because just at the precise moment where Lewis was about to pounce on Valtteri and snatch the lead was when Mrs. Codling was inquiring as to my timing mechanism, because she was pointing at the screen and going, what is it you're looking at here? And I was explaining to her the various bits of what the timing screen signifies. And I said, Lewis is about to kick Bottas's ass. Watch as this happens, and boomf, there it happened.
the prophetic Stuart Codling there.
I was able to sit on my laurels right there, which is something that, you know, to be fair, you know, we can do as journalists, and you know, a lot of the more venerable ones do, but something that, you know, Lewis Hamilton never does, and that's why he's you know, among the greatest of all time.
Indeed. Well, look, you went along to the Toto Wolff Zoom call. I say went along, you were present in it, let's put it that way. What was his explanation for why Bottas was not allowed to get the softs? He said it was a bit robust in why they decided not to do it.
Yeah, he said it was, as you said, simply that the data Mercedes had was that the hard tire would be the best choice for that final stint. And he said that the softs, there was sort of uncertainty as to whether they would make it to the end and still be holding up okay. Obviously, the gap to Max Verstappen wasn't huge. So it was sort of, if he did have a massive tire drop off, then he could have been very vulnerable. Toto said that we did see that with both Perez and with Ocon, that they put the softs on for quite a short final stint, but both of them were really struggling towards the end, particularly in Perez's case, of course. So I think that they were very clear about it. And Wolff also said that it would have confused... Wolff also said that it would have caused some confusion as well, that if you have a driver come in, your lead driver, Lewis Hamilton, and fit him with one tyre, and then have the other driver come in and go on to something else, like, there's no real way sort of to justify that or to explain it to the drivers. And because ultimately, Mercedes have always said they want to keep things equal, they want to run the drivers on sort of similar strategies as much as they can to give them that equal opportunity and keep things fair. So I think that's really what they went for. And ultimately, that if they had given Bottas those softs and they had sort of wildly performed brilliantly and allowed him to cut the gap to Lewis and overtake and take the win, I think Hamilton would have had some serious questions saying, well, why wasn't I given that tyre? So I think it's Mercedes are very good at sort of keeping that status quo and all things fair. And I think that this is the second time in a few races that Bottas has made that request, and he's not been allowed it, and that's because of how fair they want to keep things.
Well, it was interesting when Bottas came out of the pits. Obviously, he was suddenly warned as he's approaching the pit exit. His engineer tells him, you're going to have traffic as Giovinazzi and Russell sweep by. But he really could not get those hard tyres switched on. But it's interesting. I think Lewis Hamilton was having similar problems because it was just so cold on the track surface and in the air today. It was actually absolutely tipped it down with rain afterwards in the hours that followed. Just, fortunately, we were quite lucky, actually, having had our deepest and most unpleasant COVID test of the weekend. We didn't then get utterly rained on. But a few minutes later, the media centre was engulfed in a rain shower. But anyway, I'm completely wasting everybody's time by describing that. But what was interesting was that Hamilton was saying that was the big battle. It wasn't about, you know, really keeping the tyres alive to a certain degree. It was keeping them in the temperature window that was absolutely critical. And he said that he was driving the whole race, sort of learning lap by lap, understanding where he was going to, what was best just to help with those tyre temperatures, because Pirelli were quite conservative in terms of bringing, you know, sort of the hardest tyres they had to this race. The soft was what has been a medium in most of the races. So they were just concerned that the sort of the roller coaster nature, as it was described ahead of the race here at Portimao, that they would just simply eat through the tyres and be an issue. So that's why they went a bit harder. But Hamilton in complete control once those tyres had got up to temperature. There was a good little bit of fastest laps exchange between the Mercedes drivers. And then Hamilton just repeatedly lowered it again and again and again into a range that Bottas couldn't even get close to. He, as I said at the start, he's now on 92 wins. He's F1's sole all-time win record holder. But John, did you detect a little bit less fanfare this time around? Because obviously it's only one race on from him equaling Michael Schumacher, Mick Schumacher presenting that helmet. It's just the natural news cycle in terms of, it's almost like it's like having the two birthdays one day after another. It's the same thing in a way. I can understand the pedantry of, well, yeah, now he is the, you know, the sole record holder, but achieving Schumacher's record is was sort of just as iconic and difficult. Do you agree with that? You think there was a little bit less fanfare this time around?
Yeah, there was less fanfare, and I personally think you should always celebrate when a record's broken, not when it's been equaled. You know, I thought, you know, Kimi Raikkonen should be applauded when he becomes the most experienced driver, not when he equals the record. And same with Lewis. I think, you know, this afternoon should have been the moment to really celebrate that world record, because records are there to be broken, not to be equaled. I think, you know, as it goes on now, it will, you know, he'll keep beating this record and the numbers will keep going up, and there'll be, the fanfare will be totally forgotten now, and we'll end up at a number probably around 130, 140 maybe in the end, where we'll rest, and then the baton will be handed to Max Verstappen to try and beat it.
Absolutely. Max Verstappen and Lewis Hamilton joking in the press conference that Verstappen's going to have to keep going until he's 40 by the time he might be able to equal Hamilton's record. I guess sort of
he's old enough to be a granddad.
Indeed. It's interesting, I guess the other side of the when do you celebrate the record debate is, well, what if something horrible were to have happened to Hamilton and he never got there? It still would have been a great achievement matching Schumacher's record and you know, doing that far. And that, you know, it's kind of like you'd sort of miss the news of the day. As you say, John, each victory he gets after today is going to be breaking the record again in a weird way. But no, I do take your point, but yeah, I'm just obviously defending Autosport's green cover to those irritating pedants, ye olde annoying people on Twitter, etc. Let's go right back to the start of the race. Max Verstappen versus Sergio Perez. Codders, who was to blame in that collision?
That's quite a hard question, isn't it? Because the stewards decided no one was wholly to blame. Was it 50-50? Do you want me to go out on a limb here?
Always. When do you not go? When okay. Do you not go out on a limb?
Okay, right. I'm out on the limb here.
When he's reading Alan Bennett poetry in a press conference,
it's not,
I think.
Poetry, it's prose, and I can turn to my left and read some more from Alan Bennett's diaries. But,
please don't.
My impression was that Max had basically he had not performed to his maximum extent. He had disappointed himself in the first couple of corners and he was slightly flustered. And I replayed the first few corners from various angles a lot. And just the impression you got from the body language, as it were, of the car was that he was in the moment, he was a little bit flustered, is perhaps not the exactly correct word, but he sort of felt a little bit under pressure and he was being a bit reactive, and I think it was his mistake to chop across Perez and catch him there. I think it was clumsy, and in the moment he was fighting the car and fighting everyone else, and I think he'd lost a little bit of perspective of where he was on the circuit, is perhaps the best way of putting it, and maybe he wasn't really thinking about kind of the long-term consequences of what was going on.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with your limb there, Codders. It was interesting. Slightly scruffy weekend from Verstappen, not the sort of the ultimate performances that we've seen from him so far this season. Obviously, think about the Stroll collision in practice. Okay, it was practice, but it just felt extremely needless for Verstappen to get himself into that situation. It's an interesting one on Perez, because he had a pretty impressive recovery. Okay, yeah, the soft tyres really let him down at the end, and there was some very questionable defensive driving. But Luke, yeah, what did you make of Perez today after he'd been spun around?
Yeah, it was an excellent fight back, and there was a tweet I saw talking about the positions of the two Racing Point drivers. I think in the space of 20 laps they swapped positions, whereas Perez had gone from P20 to P10, Stroll had gone from P10 to P20, and it was just a real turnaround. But no, Checo was in fantastic form again, and I think he really did brilliantly to fight back, and sort of the tyre whisperer reputation that he's built up that maybe isn't seen so acutely in Formula 1 nowadays, I think he was really able to get those tyres into a good window and manage them very well. And it was only, yeah, as you say, at the end when he sort of got all the way up into obviously fifth place and was looking really, really good, that his soft tyres just began to fall apart. And then he had the likes of Gasly and Sainz bearing down on him. And the defensive move against Gasly, I mean, that rightly was hit with a reprimand, and Gasly was understandably unhappy on the team radio because it was a very, very late swerve from Perez, and Gasly really did have to back out of that move. But no, I thought it was a very strong weekend from Perez. I think he again is sort of proving why he is one of the best drivers sort of in that sort of Class B fight that we have. And I know there's sort of lots of speculation about where he's going to end up next year, and talks of obviously Williams and what he could do to possibly sort of save his F1 career and stay on the grid. But I think performances such as the one he put in all the way through this weekend, I think again just prove that he absolutely deserves a place in Formula One next season.
Indeed, just going back to the clash with Verstappen, FIA race director Michael Massey was asked after the race. He does a sort of a weird sort of virtual media briefing. I think we've talked about this before. We submit questions to people in the media centre, and then he gets asked about it. And he basically, the question was, if that hadn't happened on lap one, the clash between Verstappen and Perez, would a penalty have been applied? Because obviously there is some discretion and some leniency given into lap one. And he rather coyly said, well, unfortunately it was lap one, so that's what happened. So I think he's sort of reading between the lines. He suggests that, yeah, if that had happened later on in the race, there would have been a penalty. John, just coming to that move that Perez did, his defence against Gasly. It's actually his second reprimand of the weekend after he blocked. There was impeded. Was it not Gasly in qualifying as well? There was one. Anyway.
Yep.
Yes. Sorry, that was just off the top of my head. Thank you, Luke. Puts him on two reprimands and very close to a grid penalty soon enough. So he's going to have to be really behaving himself in the future. But yeah, how did you see that that late defensive move against Gasly?
Yeah, too aggressive. I think the TV cameras didn't catch it properly, or you kind of caught the tail end of it as the cameras followed it first time around. But when you watch Gaz's onboard, it reminded me a bit of that incident with Michael Schumacher giving Rubens Barrichello the chop, where you come and watch the, in Hungary that year, where you watch the onboard, and Gasly was quite lucky to get out of it because there was no room. It happened at the last second, and it would have been a massive accident if those wheels had kind of clashed and launched into the air. So, I think Perez did overstep the line with that. But equally, I do think Sergio was out there today knowing that he's now driving for a potential race-winning car next year.
Interesting. And what potentially race-winning car could that be, John?
I don't know. It could be from Milton Keynes.
Roundabouts, etc. Anyway, Cutters, while we're talking about a racing point driver, let's talk about the other one. I thought I'd throw it to you. I thought you might have another limb to go on to when it comes to Lance Stroll. Very, again, scruffy probably is quite a generous term for his weekend, considering the not looking in his mirrors in FP2 with Verstappen, although I am, as I said, of the opinion that Verstappen really has to take a lot of blame there. And it was interesting, we asked Michael Massey about that, or I submitted a question via the FIA's media delegates about that. Like, well, if basically the explanation was, yeah, they were both at fault for what happened. Like, Stroll should have looked in his mirrors and knew he was there, and Verstappen could have backed out of it. And it's sort of like, well, if they both did something, why are they getting away with it? If that makes sense. But his explanation of, well, it was a practice session, I was like, yeah, fair enough, but you know, it's still an accident that didn't need to happen and potentially could have put people into danger. But anyway, Stroll, yes, that incident in FP2, then he basically has a very, very similar one with Lando Norris in the race, although it's ever so slightly different because he dives to the outside and then sweeps across, but just sort of doesn't seem to expect or think about where the McLaren's going to go. And then he picks up track limits penalty and ends up with 10 seconds added to his time even before he retires. But you were WhatsApping me about what driver rating I'm going to give him. So what rating would you give him, Cotters?
Well, as I said to you in my WhatsApp message, I think a 3 would be exceedingly generous, and probably a 2. Just not really top draw driving at all from him this weekend. Just ridiculous. And I think the icing on the cake, really, apart from the various track limits penalties, was the stupidity, or the rank stupidity, of the whole Norris incident, where he basically right hooked him. Now, as someone who likes cycling, you know, I am a bloody cyclist, as people put it out there. I'm often the victim of what's known as the left hook when a car overtakes you and then basically turns left as if they've forgotten that you're there, that the minute you're outside the cone of their forward vision. And this is exactly what he did with Lando Norris. So you had where this harum scarum approach to turn one where he almost got surprised that Lando was braking for, oh, stop the press, a corner, a car in front might actually be slowing down to approach a corner. So Lance has to take to the curb to avoid a car that's braking for a corner. And to be fair to it, there's a little bit of skill involved in not having a colossal accident in the skating across the curb that then ensues. But then having actually managed to somehow get his front wheel past Norris's front wheel as they approach this corner, he then makes this direct trajectory to the apex. And this is why the stewards clobbered him in their finding. It wasn't the whole stupidity and the harum scarum nature of the whole being taken by surprise and having to go around the outside as whoop-de-doo the car ahead hits the brakes. It's the fact that he left Norris with nowhere to go, because on the inside of that curb there's a sausage curb, so Norris literally could not have taken any other angle on that corner without putting the whole nose of his car over that sausage curb and destroying his car. So he left Norris with no alternative, and it's not as if Norris has disappeared once he'd put his front wheel slightly past Norris's front wheel. The other car is still there. Memo to Lance. And to my mind, the whole sort of withdrawing him because the balance of the car was changing and we didn't want him to spin off was a little bit like the team saying, well, quite frankly, it's about time you stopped, because you're about to make an even bigger fool of yourself than you already have done.
Collis, can you not sit on the fence, please?
Okay, well, there you go. I didn't want to have a post up my arse because it's nearly bedtime. You know, it would have been painful. But, yeah, you know, we cannot equivocate when it comes to circumstances like this. And what a pig's ear of a race.
Yeah, completely, completely.
Luca's got something
to
say.
I just very quickly dip in, Cotters. You could be possibly Autosport's Grand Prix editor with that knack for driver ratings. Maybe that's what Lance Stroll will be getting. Anyway, sorry, Luke.
Do you know what? What he really needs is a touch of the Patrick Head. You know, I've seen so many stupidities. Whatever it is that you do, do it better.
But would the Patrick Head impression have been given out to the son of the team owner? Like that's the position he's in. Is he going to change like that?
Well, yeah,
Patrick Head would.
Yeah, he would have done. That's how they lost the Honda engine. Just, well, I'm not having bloody Satoru Nakajima.
Interesting. Right, sorry, Lee. Many years ago, you wanted to make a point.
That was quite a segue, wasn't it? Yes. No, you're right, Cotters. I mean, and in fact, on Lance Stroll's radio, he was asking, sort of hinting, should we retire the car, like a good sort of 15 laps before they did eventually pull him in and end his race. And he said, like, couldn't we be saving the engine here or something like that? And Racing Point said, well, you never know, there might be a safety car, there might be some rain or something like that. But it would have needed a whole lot more to give Lance Stroll any kind of sort of credibility for his performance this weekend, because it was terrible. And I mean, Lando Norris, who he's normally quite sort of a mild-mannered and rather, I wouldn't say PC, but he's sort of very, very, he's very chilled about stuff. But he was like really angry about the move after the race. As Alex touched on earlier, he used some rather colourful language over the team radio to describe Stroll's move. And afterwards he said, I don't know why he tried to be a hero. He obviously didn't learn from Friday, but he doesn't seem to learn with anything he does. It happens a lot, so I need to just make sure I stay away. And it's just, I think that was a pretty scathing judgment. And ironically, this came less than 24 hours after in Toto Wolff's virtual media session, he'd been asked about sort of the rise of pay drivers in F1 and the point made to him that we've got three sons of billionaires probably going to be on the F1 grid next year. And Toto was like, well, who shouldn't be on the F1 grid? And the journalist sort of said, well, you know, you got Lance Stroll, Latifi, Mazepin, all their fathers are very rich. And Toto went to this massive defense of Lance, and he was like, he was Italian F4 champion, an international F3 champion, and he's got two podiums and been on the front row at Monza and blah 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 blah. And he's not biased, in Toto's own words, because he definitely doesn't work with Lance's father. And it was just this massively robust defense. And but then Stroll does a performance like that, and you're kind of like, well, it really undermines everything. And there were many fans on Twitter sort of saying, like, well, how is it that Stroll is the man losing his seat next season given that performance? Because you look at Perez, Stroll, Vettel in that race. I mean, Perez was a league above the other two. So, yeah, a very, very disappointing weekend for Lance Stroll. And I fully agree, if I may chip in with my driver rating as well, that I think a 2 would be most generous.
Cool. John, what would you give him? Complete the set.
Yeah, 2 or 3. I think what was most unforgivable about it, and I sense that it seems that Lance found himself almost accidentally alongside Lando. It was as though it was like a move where he wasn't expecting, planning to do something, and suddenly found himself trying to take avoiding action on the outside, and then thought, oh, that's enough, I'll just turn in. If he hadn't had a crash on Friday at the same corner on the same circumstance of being on the outside, then you could kind of semi-forgive it as not really understanding. But having been involved in an incident on Friday, knowing full well what the consequences are and the dangers of being on the outside and not seeing the rival, you would at least think that lesson would have been taken on board when you're in a similar scenario in the race. So I think Lando is totally right that, you know, I think the worst thing about it is just not learning that lesson from Friday. So a really, really scrappy weekend. And it comes on the back of a season where Lance appears to have made some progress. That he has had some good performances and shown good speed and good race results and been battling. But equally, there's been key moments where he's let himself down. Could have won Monza, but he made a complete hash of the restart. And today, well, this weekend, I think the car's shown itself to be good. And Sergio, you know, lifted his game to, you know, perhaps his best weekend of the year so far. And it's kind of flicked around the momentum inside Racing Point.
Certainly has. I'd agree with that on Perez. That was very good, apart from the naughty defence against Gasly. John, just coming back to you, Red Bull and Verstappen, obviously in his customary third place behind the Mercedes drivers, but he was quite a long way behind at the finish, 34.5 seconds. I'm just going to reveal to everyone, I've actually got paper notes for the first time this season, because I haven't to come across them in the media sense. They haven't really been, or they've only been printing them on demand for the people that can't get it to work on their laptops, apparently. But anyway,
do you have to wash them before you pick them up?
Yeah, is it like in the gym where you have to spray them?
At the moment, I've got them in some sort of salad bowl. Anyway,
oh, make sure the bloke from the Guardian doesn't try to eat them then.
That charming fellow from The Guardian is very, very, very entertaining, giving us some good media centre gossip about various needless gripes from some idiots. Anyway, John, back to Red Bull. Obviously, as I said, yeah, Verstappen, third place, but finishing very far behind. And Christian Horner, pretty unequivocal, saying if he'd known that how long the mediums were going to last, that's what they would have gone for. And do you think that's really what cost Verstappen so much time, was not being able to start on the mediums?
Potentially, but I think it's one of those races, if the rain had come down a bit more on the first lap, if we'd had a safety car in that first phase of the race, then I think the whole outcome of the afternoon would have been different. I mean, the warm-up was so bad on the tyres that if we'd had a lap one safety car, if the rain had come down and then the Mercs slipped down the order even more, then the whole thing would have turned around, and suddenly that strategy that Red Bull picked would have been the right one to do. So I think it's one of those that you're making that decision in hindsight based on circumstances that could have been different. So, I think at various points of that race, when it was starting to settle down, I thought now would be a brilliant time for a safety car or for a bit of a proper downpour just to even it up. But by that phase, things had spread out too much. There was a little phase where Verstappen was slightly closing in on Valtteri when Valtteri was onto the hards. We thought, oh, maybe this could get quite spicy. But in the end, the gap kind of stabilised, and then it was there to the end.
Indeed, and you got the feeling that that's what Renault were trying to do with Esteban Ocon, going out well beyond 50 laps on his mediums. Obviously you were entertaining people in the Renault press conferences before the drivers turned up. How did you assess that team today?
Allegedly.
Yes, you can perhaps confirm or deny or do whatever you like, but yeah, what did you make of Renault today?
It was quite interesting, actually. I have to at this point specify that, you know, obviously we sign into these virtual press conferences at a specific time, and very often the drivers are not yet ready for us. So rather than, you know, us all just sort of sit and pick our noses or
revert to something else.
We don't want to revert back, do we? was there mention of Leslie Grantham's webcam disgrace as well? Yeah, I think we did mock a certain one of our former colleagues.
Thanks for all your help this weekend, Codders.
and Leslie Grantham's webcam disgrace was mentioned. And yeah, I did do a reading from Alan Bennett's diaries, because our host from Renault was sort of sitting there going, well, I'm sorry, I'm not like a stand-up comic. I can't really fill time like this. So I kind of felt impelled just to, you know, entertain the audience until Esteban turned up. But yeah, it was a game of two halves for Renault. Obviously, Daniel Ricciardo was on the soft tyres at the start, and he said he really struggled to warm them up, and he was sort of surprised to see Kimi Raikkonen come past him and to them have to be battling with him, because the balance wasn't quite there. I don't think the whole Renault package wasn't quite there for this race. And Johnny, you were kind of pressing them on this matter of where they actually felt they were, because the Nürburgring was a circuit and conditions where you would kind of thought they'd be similar, and yet they were stronger there. But yeah, certainly Ocon said he could have done the whole race on that one set of medium tyres, and that's why they left him out so long, because they sort of felt that there would have been an advantage there. And it was only then when he went onto the softs and they didn't work that it was like, oh, well, this didn't really work then. So both of them had to work pretty hard. I think Daniel was putting a little bit of a brave face on the fact that the strategy had engineered it, that his teammate had beaten him. I think to start the race on the soft tyres was very definitely the wrong thing to do in the long run. You had a few seconds in the sun if you managed to switch them on, but after that it was a very hard slog. So I think he did the best he possibly could, and Ocon, you know, given that they were going to stick him on the softs after that, I suppose he did the best he could as well. Had they put him on hards after that and maybe stopped him earlier, things could have panned out a little bit differently. But I think they probably felt they came away with the maximum they could possibly have done this weekend.
Indeed. Well, let's come on to talk about a pair of friends who finished fourth and fifth. That's Charles Leclerc and Pierre Gasly. Leclerc, again, very, very quick in qualifying when Sebastian Vettel was definitely not very quick for Ferrari. And Gasly absolutely charging in the race. It was interesting because he seemed to be one of the few drivers that could make the soft tyres work in that first stint. But what did you make of Gasly today?
Yeah, like you say, it's a brilliant performance. He made the soft tyres work and he made them last, which was pretty crucial to the outcome of the race for him. And it was almost disappointing for those of us who attended the Christian Horner press conference, which, as usual, happened with 2 minutes' notice. You have to sit waiting for your email to ping. And for him to sort of pour cold water on Pierre's chances of getting back into that Red Bull seat, because certainly for me, that was an impressively controlled race. People say that he's a temperamental driver, that he's psychologically fragile, that he needs a car that's friendly towards him. And I would say that maybe the third of those caveats applied here, in that clearly the AlphaTauri car is less unstable at the back. It's a little bit less edgy than the Red Bull. But you know, he's a driver who's maximising what he has in front of him and maximising what he has underneath him. And to actually make those soft tyres work over that first stint, I think was the cornerstone to him having a great result today.
Absolutely. And indeed, as I said, another very fine performance from Pierre Gasly. John, what was the feeling down at Ferrari after the race? You got one driver very, very strong all weekend, the other one not strong in qualifying, but did at least go forward in the race to claim the final point, Sebastian Vettel. What was the team saying afterwards about its weekend?
Positive in terms of Charles and his performance. They obviously bought a three-staged upgrade package for the last three races. No dramatic, you know, it's not a dramatic leap forward, but it's delivered a little bit. So I asked Mattia whether he felt that the step forward they've made since Mugello in particular was down to the upgrades, or was it the track? He thinks it's partly the upgrades. He thinks the midfield battle is so tight, actually, that, you know, even just a 1/10 or 2/10 difference is making the difference between qualifying 12th and qualifying 4th. But they're still mindful that maybe the track configuration of Nürburgring and here helped them. It's high downforce, which the car's got high downforce. It's just not very efficient. And this isn't a track that demands efficiency. So they still want to see a bit more progress. And another difficult weekend for Sebastian Vettel. He's struggling with the car. He says it doesn't have confidence on the edge. He feels that Charles is able to feel the grip of the car better. And when you can feel the grip of the car better, you can push the car even harder. So he's trapped in this vicious circle. Some comments that Vettel made to RTL tonight, talking about biting his tongue, nor to say why he thinks there's a difference between the two cars. There's fuel speculation that maybe Ferrari are favouring one driver over the other or handing them different equipment, but Mattia's shot that down. When you look at the Constructors' Championship battle, you know, they're currently 33 points behind Racing Point, and they want to finish third in the Constructors' Championship. So there's a lot of money at stake in moving forwards. They're still in reach for this team if they can start rattling the results. So it actually makes no sense for them to be deliberately hobbling one driver to not finish in third place in the Constructors. So you think from that perspective, it's not happening. But what I sense may have happened is that this upgrade package has played towards Charles maybe more than Sebastian, because Charles admitted tonight, talking about the recent progress of the car, and he says, yeah, well, I'm happy with the upgrades and they're suiting my driving style. So maybe this is the answer as to why we're seeing this difference between the two drivers.
Well, it certainly makes sense considering Leclerc is there for the long term. But anyway, we head back to Italy for yet another Ferrari home race. Gone, Codders, what have you got to say about the Scuderia?
I was just going to say that Vettel had to have a long sitting on the hard tyres. And to be fair to him, he actually made that strategy work. You know, obviously, he was starting from a disadvantageous position, which is caused by his poor qualifying performance. But he made a strategy which wasn't going to set the world alight actually work. So he did a fairly good job, but probably not one that is concomitant with the amount he's paid as a four-time world champion.
Well, just before we move on to our final topic for this podcast, I just think it's worth noting how well Leclerc did to qualify on the medium tyres, because really only this year it's been the Mercedes and the Red Bull that's been able to do that, because they've got such a pace advantage. So yeah, hats off to Leclerc for getting through there. Let's come to our final topic, which is Portimão on the track itself, the first Portuguese Grand Prix since 1996, F1's first race weekend visit to Portimão. As we explained in another podcast, we're not calling it the Algarve International Circuit per the original instructors in the Autosport Star Guide, because we have changed it for very sensible editorial reasons. But Luke, your first visit to Portugal, my first visit to Portugal, do you think F1 should come back next year if the option is there?
Yes. Yeah. I'd never been to Portugal before. I'd never been to Portimão before, and it's been for the most part, as we are about to get onto, of course, it's been a very pleasant weekend. It's been nice. It's a nice area. Portimão itself is very nice. Obviously, like a resort town, basically. Everyone speaks English, obviously, because you've got all the Brits come over. They're advertising pints for 90 cents and things like that. So it's all very catered to the British tourists. So I think it's it would be a very popular weekend, I think, for F1 if they were to commit to doing this race on the long term. The track itself, obviously, all the drivers sort of said about the resurfacing and how difficult that made grip levels. But we did see some really nice side-by-side battles. I believe it was Raikkonen and Sainz who had sort of a good sort of sequence of corners, and Perez and Ocon as well. So those kind of fights, that's what we'd like to see. So I think the track itself, it does tick a lot of boxes. The big thing though that they really, really do need to get on top of is the traffic situation. And I think anyone who went to the French Grand Prix in 2018 will have flashbacks of just how terrible that was organized and just what an absolute logistical mess it was. And you had fans stuck in cars. Codders was obviously caught up in that mess as well. And it was a nightmare. But the French Grand Prix, they reacted and they were like, okay, we're going to put in measures, and they did that very well for the following year. Now, Alex and I set off this morning. We left, what, 4 hours before the planned race start?
Which was actually a reaction to getting caught in traffic on the way into qualifying and thinking, oh, we should probably leave about an hour later than we had, sorry, an hour earlier than we had been planning. And yeah.
And then the journey that should have taken about 25 minutes ended up taking 2.5 hours, and we got sent around all kinds of motorways. Portuguese Rosas, don't know what they were doing. It took an argument with one to get onto the right road to actually get us to the track that was meant to get us there, and that we were allowed to go on because, of course, we've got an F1 media sticker, therefore we get a certain privilege to go to the track.
Well, prodded it meaningfully as you went, you know, you
we certainly did.
We're media media, darling.
Well, it certainly wasn't the fact that we wanted to get ahead of anybody. It was just the fact that there was the car park we were supposed to park in. They were going to send us to completely the wrong direction. I don't know where we would have ended up. So yeah, it wasn't a case of we were demanding any preferential treatment. It was just we need to be allowed to get to the bit where we can, when we can do our jobs. But yeah, it was absolutely appalling. It was horrific at times. And also reports unconfirmed, we are going to be getting in contact with the promoters of the event, that there were fans denied entry to the race because things got so late, and pushing and shoving with people not letting them in. Obviously, as I said, unverified, don't know how true that is, but we saw it on social media. And if that's true, that's even more unacceptable. And a source I spoke to suggested that, yeah, the track's great, but the organisers just aren't used to putting on a massive event like this. And if they want it to come back, no guarantees, who knows what's going to happen in the future. They've got to sort that out, because it was absolutely appalling today. But anyway, that's Luke and I's gripe. What did you guys make, John? What did you think of Portimao being on the F1 calendar?
And how calm were you for those 2.5 hours this morning, Alex?
Extremely calm. I tell you what, I was slightly more calm yesterday when I had a little bit of a logistical bit of forgetfulness that I'll reveal on our end of year podcast. But anyway, yeah. Anyway, well, as I said, you'll have to wait for the end of the season, John. Yeah. What did you make of Portimao?
I liked it. I thought it looked great on TV. The elevation was great. That helicopter shot that they had of which caught the final four or five corners looked fantastic. I liked the cars popping over the brow on the start finish straight, and I loved the last corner. Just the way the cars came through there looked fantastic. And I mean, actually, I asked Daniel Ricciardo tonight, you know, why this track on paper shouldn't be good for overtaking, because there's no really heavy, you know, long straight into a braking zone. You haven't got what used to be thought as the way to make a good racetrack would be is to have a super slow corner, long straight, other super slow corner. So on paper, it should have been terrible for racing, but it worked. And I asked Daniel why this was. He says one factor was the low grip surface. So a lot of mistakes was allowing a bit more side-by-side action. But you think key to it actually was having a flat-out long final corner onto the straight, because it allows you to pick up the toe much earlier so you can close in on the cars ahead, which maybe in the end contributed to DRS being a bit too powerful. But he thinks it's an important lesson for racetracks. He says you look at Barcelona, which went from a high-speed final corner to a slow speed chicane. He says by the time you've balanced out the concertina effect of the car in front gaining extra traction and accelerating first and got into the toe, you're halfway down the straight, so there's no chance to overtake at the first corner, whereas here you're picking up the toe much earlier. So he says Barcelona should go back to what it used to be, a high speed corner onto the straight. So I think there's some important lessons to take away from this weekend, because I thought it was, you know, a really good race today, tons of action, and some of those side by side moments were fantastic.
That's what used to happen in Hungary, wasn't it? That they had the concertina effects at the final corner. It was only when they extended the straight a little bit that remedied that.
Indeed. And Cotters, what did you make of the elevation changes? There was an amazing question pitched to Michael Massey about the dimensions in the FIA guidelines of basically how steep the hills could be and whether that would expose the cars too much. It was so incredible. I think Massey very tactfully suggested that he wasn't quite aware off the top of his head of those dimensions and that exact wording. But yeah, an entertaining track. I actually thought, having watched it trackside in FP1, it was absolutely phenomenal. Brilliant venue once you got inside.
Yeah, it looked good, and I envied Luke having gone for a run round the circuit. Because did you as well? Oh, very good. Well, I envy you both of having run through. Who won?
Oh, what was your time?
I don't know. I think it was fairly close. But okay. Again,
oh, don't give me this. I don't know if it's not on Strava. It didn't
it
happen.
It is on Strava. Hang on.
I stopped it three times to take a quick photo, but I will.
Oh, excuse coming.
Yeah,
in.
Well, I know, because this is so millennial, isn't it? Sorry, I had to take a selfie
for the gram.
It didn't
exist. Obviously. Yeah.
I did that as well.
Oh, if you haven't grammed it, then it hasn't happened.
It's completely even circumstances.
Could you not have run it twice, and you have your one run where you stop and fart around doing your photos for Instagram, and then you have the proper series?
No, because
run.
We were hard at work on the other nights, apart from Saturday night, where we definitely had a nice dinner and some beers. I was 24 minutes, 33 seconds.
Oh, 24:50.
Yes.
Oh,
victory.
Well, shouldn't have stopped to take those photos. Damn.
Oh, fabulous. It looked good. And interestingly, Mrs. Codling also, who, you know, I didn't go down to the Lord Heseltine Theatre to watch this Grand Prix. I watched it upstairs.
What's your upstairs and called?
The cat house.
Cat house?
Well, do you know, they
it
treat
sounds,
it as
it their sounds
own.
A bit seedy. Anyway, so carry on.
Would maybe to you, Alex, but... in the normal, the living room, whatever it is, not the Lord Heseltine Theatre. And I'd caution Mrs. Codling that it was not likely to be a fantastically thrilling race, because the layout of the circuits appeared on the face of it to militate against overtaking and thrillingness. She looked up from her Kindle and went, well, as if to say, well, go downstairs to the Lord Heseltine Theatre and watch it with your iPad, with your facts and figures that I can't
with your timing mechanisms
on it. Your timing mechanisms. And she did actually, a while later, looked up from the Kindle and said, well, you know, this looks quite uppy down. It's quite an interesting circuit, isn't it? And I was quite amazed, actually, some interest. But, it looked good. And the... It didn't look artificial. You know, if you look at some circuits that have been built in the past 20 years that feature elevation changes that have been done by earth-moving equipment, for instance, the Slovakia Ring, which basically has a mound in the middle that is the result of bulldozers at work, it just feels sort of fairly natural, which is kind of puts it in the context of other circuits that make use of topography. You know, we all worship Spa, another great circuit to run or cycle around, which follows the natural contours of the land. It didn't feel artificial. It was very nice in that regard.
Absolutely, Andy. Some of those when coming down the steep bits of this track, you were sprinting without even thinking that you should be sprinting or like telling your legs to do that, because the gravity was having such an effect. It was so steep. So it was definitely very interesting. I mean, we are being quite flippant but also quite punchy about the traffic situation and things like that. But it's worth noting that because of COVID, I mean, that's the reason why we're here, first of all, but there were hardly any fans here. It was like 29,000. It was massively reduced. Imagine if there'd been 100,000 or 120,000, it would have been complete chaos. So anyway, yeah.
They didn't really look very socially distanced from where I was watching either.
No, I agree with that. Because we, from the media centre, we had a view of the final grandstand. And yeah, I was sort of looking over thinking, oh, that's quite full. Very strange.
Indeed. But there we go. We should bring this podcast to an end. I've got an enormous amount of writing to do before I'm allowed to go to bed, which I will like to crack onto. So anyway, I should say thank you very much to the three of you for coming onto this podcast tonight, and thanks to everybody listening along. Now, just before we go, we'd like to remind you that the latest issue of Autosport magazine came out on Thursday and is available on the supermarket shelves and in newsagents, as well as on the doormats of subscribers. There'll be a new issue of the magazine for you to pick up every Thursday, packed full of news, analysis and the usual stunning photography. And of course, if you want unlimited access to Autosport from the comfort of your home, visit autosport.com/plus to find out how to subscribe to our digital package. We'll be back soon with another episode of the Autosport Podcast.